Next case is 04-847, Henry C.W. versus Mark Worrell. Mr. Cassay.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Richard Cassay. I'm representing the Summit County Children's Services Board in this case. This is a certified conflict case, and briefly stated, the issue is when a children's services agency files a motion under 2151-414, asserting grounds under 2151-414-B1D, which for simplicity's sake I'll refer to as the 12 out of 22 grounds, must the child have been in the temporary custody of the agency for the 12 months when the motion is actually filed, or is it sufficient that the 12 months be satisfied when the hearing on the permanent custody motion is held? Now, the Ninth District Court of Appeals in the CW case actually referred to an earlier case of theirs, which is In Re KG. What happened was the Ninth District, prior to In Re KG, which I think came down in early 04, had indicated that when such a motion is filed asserting the 12 out of 22 grounds under 414B1D, 2151-414B1D, it was sufficient that the grounds exist, the 12 out of 22, exist at the time the permanent custody hearing was held. And there are other appellate districts in the state that agree with that. So that was the context in which the CW case was actually tried. However, subsequent to the judgment in CW, the Ninth District decided the In Re KG case, in which they, in effect, reconsidered their prior rulings and held that, no, the 12 out of 22 grounds must exist when the permanent custody motion is filed. Now, this CW case, this appeal is actually an examination of the KG case, because in CW, the Ninth District simply basically cited KG and reversed the judgment.
Counsel, once the permanent custody motion is filed, they have 180 days. The court has 180 days to hear it. Is that correct?
120 days.
120 days, I'm sorry.
120 days by statute, although that...
And then you have the extensions that are possible, and we could be working at 180 or 6 months, correct? 4 months, 6 months.
The statute, while it states a preference for 120 days, it is not mandatory. That time can be extended without affecting the jurisdiction of the court, yes.
All right, so let's just work with the 120 days. If your argument is that it is permissible that the 12 and 22 criteria is met at the time of the hearing,
yes,
the permanent custody hearing,
yes,
you would advocate then that, as a rule of thumb, you could go back to 8 months, but no sooner, once the to file your permanent custody? Is that what you, I mean, obviously that would be the effect of any decision that we would make, agreeing with you.
The statute, I think the way the statute reads, Your Honor, and I think it's 414 A, gives the court 120 days to have the hearing, but there's nothing in there that says it can't have it at 60. So it doesn't, there's nothing in there that says it can't.
But you wouldn't know when the court was going to have the hearing when you filed the motion for permanent custody.
That would be speculation on the agency's part when they filed the motion, when the court would have the hearing.
When Children's Services takes a child for temporary custody, there's a responsibility for a reunification plan.
Yes.
And that reunification plan, does that continue once the motion for permanent custody is filed?
Yes.
And can you reconcile that for me then? How does Children's Services file a motion for permanent custody 8 months into the custody, theoretically, have a reunification plan that obviously has some problems, or I would presume they weren't filing, and continue with a reunification attempt while on the parallel track they're moving for permanent custody? I'm trying to resolve that against the requirement that you give the full year for the reunification plan to be effective, and then see where you are according to the statute and move for permanent custody.
I'll attempt to answer what I think is the first question that you asked. There is not necessarily an irreconcilable difference between an agency filing for permanent custody and the agency's duty to continue to attempt reunification. Now, the reunification statute is 2151-419, and that statute says very plainly that only if there has to be certain criteria met before the agency is relieved of its obligation to attempt reunification, and on top of that, the agency just can't arbitrarily decide that one of these criteria is met, and now we're going to stop reunification efforts. The court has to order, the court has to find that one of these listed criteria are met before the reunification effort stops. Now, whether or not the agency, if the agency asserts 12 out of 22 in its permanent custody motion, whether or not 12 months have been met, or whether or not 12 months have not been met, the agency's duty to attempt reunification is not affected. I cited the In re Elliott case on that point in the brief. There, the permanent custody was granted, and the agency, in fact, had temporary custody of the child for 22 months, but had only attempted reunification for 7. And the Court of Appeals in Elliott reversed the permanent custody judgment, saying, regardless of how long the agency has temporary custody of that child, the agency must attempt reunification under 419. So to try to answer your question, Your Honor, if you're just looking at 12 out of 22 when the permanent custody motion is granted, if there's 12 months are met or they're not met, reunification continues as a mandatory duty on the agency. Now, I think there was a second question in there dealing with the one-year period, which would be the standard period that a permanent custody case would take unless there was extensions granted. There can be 2 extensions of 6 months each. One response I would have to that is, under the Ninth District's rationale, you're not going to get, an agency cannot even file a permanent custody motion asserting 12 out of 22 in the ordinary case, because 12 months is the ordinary case. And I think the permanent custody motion has to be filed, I think 30 days before the sunset date. I believe that's true. So what that means is, under the Ninth District's holding here, any agency is not going to be able to file under 12 out of 22, I think, unless we get into an extended period. And that's nowhere in the statutes, what I think that result is, but I think that's going to be the result.
If we adopted your argument, I guess the agency could file after the agency had custody of a child for 2 months. Could it not?
It could. It would be rash to do so, but it could be.
Doesn't that seem to, there has to be some reason that the General Assembly wanted the agency to have custody of the child before it filed for permanent custody. How do we match up your answer to my question with what appears to be some legislative intent? Not sure what it is, but it seems to be there.
Well, on the part of Summit County Children's Services Board, we would say that the statutes, the pertinent statutes, are not ambiguous. In other words, 2151.414b1 clearly states that the juvenile court judge, at the time of the hearing, will determine whether or not any of the factors under 414B are present, and in addition, determine whether or not it's in the best interest of the child under 414D to grant permanent custody. Now, another statute that I think plays in here, Your Honor, is 2151.413. A of that statute is what the court in In re Dial looked at, the conflict case here, which gives an agency, in other words, it's permissive. They can file a permanent custody motion whenever they want. Doesn't mean it's going to be granted. Doesn't mean they don't need to think about what they're doing before they file it, but they can file a permanent custody motion at any time. Under 413D2, that statute requires the agency to file for permanent custody when 12 out of 22 are met. Now, I think that is what the Ninth District has done. They have read out of 413A the ability of the agency to file a permissive motion on 12 out of 22 and relegated the agencies to only the mandatory motion under 413D2 when there's no language supporting that result in the statutes, quite the contrary. So, I grant you, it's kind of counterintuitive. Why would an agency file a permanent custody motion before, at an early point in the game? I think if they file it too early, like I said, I think it could be very rash, because, for one thing, even though there's that 120-day period in the statute, and the Ninth District in NCW talks about delays on delays, there's no reason to suppose that in every case there's going to be any type of delay. You may have a juvenile court that's going to get the motion, have a pretrial, and hold a hearing, in which case an agency which has tried to file a motion too early is going to lose. So it's not really the best bet for them to do so.
But if that's the case, why wouldn't it also be true that it would make sense to wait? I mean, it appeared to me that what's happening is that there's a backlog, even with the statutory limits, that you want to get your case filed so that it gets on the schedule, so that the hearing is going to occur. But if there's not, if you're saying there are courts, hopefully there are courts that follow that statute strictly, then there's not that need, is there, to file early? I mean, I'm just still trying to figure out what the General Assembly had some reason for wanting the agencies to have custody for 12 months.
Well, again, Your Honor, going back to 413D2, when the agency has temporary custody for 12 months out of the consecutive 22-month period, they must file. That's what the General Assembly has told the agencies. And I don't think anybody here, before you is going to have a problem with that. But I think the issue here is, can they file prior to that, or must you read away one part of the statute and give effect only to the other part of the statute? I don't know if that's a good answer to your question, but probably the best I can do right now.
That's probably the best you can do, yes. That's all I ask.
I think I have, I'll just use up all my time. I'll not reserve any. Now, the Ninth District Court of Appeals discerned this ambiguity in the statutes, and one of the grounds was, I think we've touched on it already, the delay that might take place before the hearing is held. Another one was the reasonable efforts, and I think I've tried to answer that for you too, that the agency has to maintain a reasonable efforts posture. Then the other asserted ground in the Ninth District case was the fundamental principle that the grounds for a permanent custody motion must exist when the permanent custody motion is filed. Now, what the Ninth District looked at, though, was Juvenile Rule 19, which states that the motion must state with particularity the grounds upon which it is based. My answer would be, if the agency says 12 out of 22, that's stating with particularity. The Court of Appeals then implied a further finding that the grounds have to exist at the time the motion is filed. Again, I think it's intuitively we would think that, yeah, that should be so. However, when you look at the statutes, 414D3 and 413A and D, this is the way the legislature has written these statutes. So I think we have to live within that framework, and my time is up, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cassay. Mr. Reed.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Justices, opposing counsel. My name is Joel Reed, and I represent the appellee, Mr. Mark Worrell, in this action, who is the father of this child, C.W. As the court is aware, specifically I'm asking this court today to uphold the ruling in the Ninth District Court of Appeals and hold specifically that where a Children's Services Agency files a permanent custody motion pursuant to 2151414 and asserts grounds under 2151414B1D, that the child must be in the temporary custody of the Children's Services Agency for at least 12 months of a consecutive 22-month period at the time of the filing of the motion, not at the time that the permanent custody trial commences. I'm not arguing today to this court that Revised Code 2151413 or 414 is unconstitutional. I'm only asking this court to make a ruling that the Children's Services Agencies must be fair and wait the full 12 months before they file the motion asking to terminate a parent's rights. As the court is aware, the purpose of House Bill 484 in Ohio in 1999 was to speed up the permanency planning for children that were still in foster care. One of the reforms to the permanent custody statutes in 1999 was to add the 12 of 22 provision. Another reform to the statutes includes a list of events that trigger a court's ability to delete the requirement of CSB to utilize reasonable efforts of reunification. These two reforms have made it much easier for the state to prevail in permanent custody actions. The two-prong test discussed previously has become much less cumbersome for the court due to the convenience of merely choosing a single factor to satisfy an otherwise difficult prong to the permanent custody requirements, this factor being the child's been in custody for 12 of 22 months. After a determination of best interest has been made, a court need only calculate the amount of time the child has been placed in the custody of the agency. Because this calculation has become so increasingly critical to the court's final analysis of the evidence, the most extreme caution must be utilized in making sure that all procedural and constitutional rights have been safeguarded for the parents. In no other case does the importance of this strict adherence to the requirements of the statute seem more obvious than the case of CW. As previously discussed, the trial court relied solely on the 12 of 22 when deciding the second prong of the permanent custody test. The trial court basically did a cursory review of the amount of time the child had been in custody as of the date of the trial, and then skipped on to best interest before ruling that the motion for permanent custody should be granted.
But isn't that what the statute says? The court may grant permanent custody of a child to move into the court determines that the hearing held pursuant, and then section D is the child has been in the temporary custody of one or more public service agencies or private for 12 or more months, you know, the statute. It seems to relate to, doesn't it seem to relate to the day of the hearing, that that's the critical time? It doesn't say anything about filing.
Well, Judge, I would argue that there are many factors the court needs to look at when satisfying the first prong, the 12 to 22 of one of those. But the other factors, including the argument that a child cannot or should not be returned, requires some analysis. Some evidence needs to be submitted, some facts. With the 12 of 22, this is such a very powerful tool to have available, there is no real analysis. So you're correct, that is one way a court can get beyond the one prong of the test, is just to find 12 of 22. It's very easy, and that's why we're arguing that out of fairness, It should apply at the time that it's actually alleged.
Well, but it still has to, the court still has to find it's in the best interest of the child, doesn't it, to grant permanent custody?
Yes, Your Honor.
It's not enough just to say it's been, the child's been in the custody of the agency for 12 months.
Correct.
Has to find best interest, doesn't it?
After they go beyond the first prong, which would be the 12 or 22, or the other factors, abandonment, orphanage, or the child cannot or should not be returned, then they would move on to the second prong, which is best interest. That's correct. And Judge, just kind of dovetailing on the comment that you just made, there are other areas. If this court were to rule that you cannot use the 12 of 22 as a factor in making your findings unless it's actually in existence when it's pled, then some of the factors the court would need to look at, some of the evidence I alluded to earlier would be under 2151.414E, parental utilization of medical, mental health services, disabilities of a parent, disabilities of the child, dependency issues, abuse issues, communication, visitation with the child, a parent's time of incarceration, if any, abandonment, and previous custodial history. These are all factors that a court would be required to look at if they were unable to just choose the 12 of 22 route and skip beyond the first prong and goes right to the second prong. We agree with the analysis of the Ninth District Court of Appeals in KG and CW in that the motions for PC must be alleged at the time. The grounds must exist. Where no other grounds exist under the second prong of the test, fundamental fairness demands that a parent be given full 12 months to work toward reunification. Because there are numerous grounds to file for permanent custody under the first prong, we do not think that it's fair to have that tool available to just skip and do the 12 of 22. My next comment goes to some of the inquiries made by Justice O'Connor regarding the fact that you can have a permanent custody motion filed, and then there's an argument that, well, Children's Services Board still has a duty to use reasonable efforts anyway. And I understand there is some case law from other districts that would say that. My argument would be to that point, when a motion for permanent custody is filed in juvenile court, is basically a record is being made that the agency has made a determination that the parent has failed. That is only the only decision that can be made in the child's best interest is to terminate their parental rights. And I don't think that it is logical for us to believe that when the agency files a motion that the social worker is going to maintain the same degree of communication with the parent and assist them 100% efforts to achieve the case plan objectives if, in fact, they're advocating to terminate that parent's rights. I need not remind this court as well that there are many cases that have stated that it is a fundamental right of a parent to the care, custody, and control of their child, that actions calling for permanent termination of rights must be afforded every procedural due process right, and in fact, that a motion for permanent custody is akin to the death penalty in criminal cases. Evidence of permanent custody hearings must be proven by clear and convincing evidence. This is another example of how the court has put strict guidelines on what the court must find before they can grant such a motion. I do not believe that the trial court in this case or this court would sanction an attorney that would file a medical malpractice case where he has a client that is severely injured and then put into the complaint that a death has occurred. And I do think that that is analogous to what we're doing here. The agency is filing a motion, and we could conceivably have it 2, 3, 4 months after the child gets into custody, saying 12 of 22, thinking, well, by the time the trial rolls around, certainly with the court's docket right now, it will be 12 months, so we'll go ahead and put it in anyway. It's very easy to jump to other issues that can do this as well. Many times in these case plans, there are requirements for parenting classes, for maintaining stable housing, to maintain sobriety. A parent could be doing very well on their case plan. In fact, have housing and have a job where the social worker might have some kind of gut intuition that, well, 6 months from now or 3 months from now when we get around to trying the case, they won't have a job and they probably will be using drugs again. We'll go ahead and put it in the motion now that they have failed in their drug treatment and they lack adequate housing. And if the court is going to allow the agency to allege a child has been in custody for an entire year when, in fact, it's only been a matter of months, as in this case, it was 9 months.
But it doesn't, see, I guess that's where I'm quibbling with you. It doesn't really say that the agency has to allege that, does it?
No, sir, it doesn't.
Am I missing something about how it practically works? But the statute just says, at the time of the hearing, the child has been in the custody of the agency for 12 months.
And I would agree with that, Your Honor, but there are different ways to file for permanent custody. Under the 2151-413A, that is permissive. The agency can file for permanent custody under that portion of the statute, and they don't need to allege 12 or 22. If they have the facts to satisfy the first prong, showing either we have abandonment, orphanage, or that the child cannot or should not be returned for any number of reasons, they don't need to allege 12 or 22. So we're not taking away any of the tools the Children's Services Board has in proceeding with these actions. All we're asking is if you're going to allege the 12 of 22 and give the court that option, that it should be correct at the time you file the motion. In conclusion, filing this case submits that the logical purpose of the 12-month delay imposed on the CSB is to give the parents an adequate opportunity to rectify the problems which initially forced the child into custody. The procedures of the agency interference are generally graduated in nature. They start out sometimes with protective supervision, up to temporary custody, and ultimately permanent custody in some cases. Specifically, father in this case contends that the procedural mandate set forth by the legislature in 2151-414 allow parents a final opportunity to redeem past indiscretions and conform to the requirements of the case plan. The 12-month waiting period under 414 was enacted as a procedural safeguard imposed before the finality of permanent custody. A children's services agency should not be allowed to deprive the parents of this opportunity. Based on the purpose and intent of the legislation and given the gravity of permanently terminating parental rights, this court must hold that a children's services agency is required to have temporary custody of a minor child 12 months before the filing of the motion. Therefore, a child services agency should not be able to bypass the 12-month waiting period before filing their motion. Based on the arguments and in the best interest and fairness of substantial justice, the father is respectfully requesting this court affirm the judgment of the Ninth District Court of Appeals to remand this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reed.
Thank you.
Mr. Katsay, you waived your rebuttal. Yes, you have. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.
Thank you.